to be excommunicated, to be outside of real communion with the real successor of St. Peter, is in fact a jeopardy to your salvation.
In a decades-long disagreement with the reforms of Vatican II, the Traditionalist Society of St. Pius X, or SSPX, heads next week towards a full break with the Catholic Church as its leadership defies the Vatican and threatens to consecrate new bishops. Exclusive commentary and analysis ahead.
With the data centers, it is unbelievably ugly.
They're hard to accept because there's so many here already.
The construction of data centers booms across the country as artificial intelligence demands power to fuel it. What does the rush to be online mean for the human heart? We have a Catholic response.
So we're just so excited, and we keep on praying for the people, for their hearts, and for our nation.
And a conversation with this summer's perpetual pilgrims, traveling the entire length of the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage Route. Spiritual inspiration and lessons along the trail. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
But at the end, they must give the answer when God, as judge, is asking them what sins they made against the unity of the church in the revealed truth.
A leading voice on doctrine and liturgy speaks out against the Society of St. Pius X as the traditionalist group appears to move forward in defiance of papal orders, risking a schism that could lead to the excommunication of its leaders and bishops. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Since it was founded in 1970, the Society of St. Pius X, or SSPX, has often had a fraught relationship with the Vatican. Next week, the group intends to consecrate four new bishops without the approval of the Vatican, potentially rupturing its relationship with Rome and incurring excommunication. Ahead of the consecrations, EWTN News spoke exclusively with Cardinal Gerhard Müller, a prominent voice in the church who once served as the top Vatican official on doctrine.
At this moment, I don't see a chance for a conversion of them.
Cardinal Gerhard Müller has long advocated for the traditional Latin Mass. But this week, in an exclusive interview with EWTN News, the former head of the Vatican's doctrinal office calls the SSPX's plan to consecrate bishops a schismatic act, resulting in immediate excommunication from the church. Müller's concern is authority, not liturgy.
Right. These are two absolutely different questions. One is a question of the dogmatics of the faith, and the other is a form of the liturgy. Ordinations against, without the Pope, are absolutely impossible against the will of God. And who is working against of God will be excommunicated.
The SSPX announced in February it would consecrate its own bishops on July 1st without a papal mandate in order to replace its aging bishops and ordain more priests. According to canon law, without the Vatican's approval, these consecrations would be valid but illicit and would incur a penalty of automatic excommunication. Last month, Cardinal Victor Manuel Fernandez, the current prefect of the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, issued a final warning to the SSPX ahead of the consecrations that moving forward constituted a schismatic act. When speaking to reporters last week, Pope Leo XIV said he was considering a final appeal to the society.
Certainly, division among Christians is always a painful matter, but they refuse to accept certain fundamental elements of the church, beginning with various points of the Second Vatican Council. And if they make those choices, I am sorry, but we must move forward.
This is not the first time the SSPX has faced excommunication. In 1988, the Society's founder, French Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre, consecrated four bishops in direct defiance of Pope St. John Paul II. Pope Benedict XVI later lifted that excommunication, and Pope Francis allowed SSPX priests to hear confessions and witness weddings. Pope Leo has also made efforts to build a bridge to the SSPX. This year, Shortly after the SSPX announced the upcoming consecrations, Colonel Fernandez hosted the Society's Superior General for a conversation, offering to begin a dialogue on doctrinal disagreements, but discouraging the Society from its plan. Francis Rocha, senior Vatican analyst for EWTN News, says Pope Leo's approach echoes his predecessor's emphasis on obedience and dialogue.
He is willing to dialogue, but not there are things that are not negotiable. So I would say there's been a consistent line, pretty much in the essentials.
Despite the warning from Rome, the SSPX seemed fully ready to move forward with the consecrations. On Wednesday, SSPX sent an open letter and profession of faith to Pope Leo and the cardinals ahead of this weekend's consistory. The document details more than 150 statements defending the Society's beliefs on church teaching, including fidelity to the traditional Latin Mass and a rejection of ecumenism. Father Thomas Petrie, Dominican friar and theologian, says the document reflects the Society's doctrinal concerns with Vatican II.
Well, I think most Catholics who read the 28-page profession of faith are going to find that we agree with 95-98% of it. What I don't appreciate or agree with is their insistence that it seems to us, they said, that it's going in every direction but the right one. That is a judgment. That is a categorical judgment, insisting that nothing correct has been done, nothing correct has been taught or preached since the papacy of Pope St. Pius XII.
Cardinal Mueller notes that though the controversy is about doctrine, many people of goodwill prefer the traditional Latin Mass, but discourages Catholics from participating in the Masses of schismatic priests and bishops.
Everybody who wants to be a Catholic Christian, he has to accept Holy Trinity, the Incarnation, salvation in Jesus Christ, eternal life, but also the sacramentality of the Church is not only a worldly institution for religious actions, social actions, but is the visible presence of the body of Jesus Christ.
In the Catholic Church, there are a number of established communities of men and women in which the sacraments are celebrated in the traditional or extraordinary form, and they are communities in full communion with Rome, one being the Institute of Christ the King Sovereign Priest. The Institute celebrates the traditional Latin Mass, and the priests live according to the spirituality of St. Francis de Sales. It received canonical recognition in 1990 and today has an international presence, including in more than one dozen U.S. states. The Priestly Fraternity of St. Peter, or FSSP, is another prominent society offering the traditional Latin Mass, or TLM. It was founded in 1988 by priests who broke away from the SSPX after that order's founder defied the Holy See. The Priestly Fraternity of St. Peter is active in 39 dioceses in the U.S., in addition to having a global presence. And just last week, Bishop Michael Burbidge of Arlington, Virginia, approved a new chaplaincy to serve local Catholics who attend pre-Vatican II traditional Latin Mass. Called the Chaplaincy of Our Lady of Victory, it will be led by two priests from the Priestly Fraternity of St. Peter. It will serve the needs of Catholics who attend Mass and receive sacraments in the extraordinary form. The chaplaincy does not add an additional location for the TLM in the diocese, but formalizes an arrangement that had already been in place unofficially for some time. And joining us now is Bishop James Conley from the Diocese of Lincoln, Nebraska. The diocese is home to the Priestly Fraternity of St. Peter's Our Lady of Guadalupe Seminary for the FSSP's North American District. Your Excellency, thank you so much for joining us. As we just mentioned, the FSSP does have a significant presence in your diocese. In addition to the seminary there, they also serve at a local parish, I believe. Tell us, what does the Priestly Fraternity offer to the faithful in your diocese? And how has your ongoing relationship with the FSSP deepened your own understanding of the traditional liturgical movement within the church?
Sure. Yeah, the FSSP came to our diocese under my predecessor's tenure over 25 years ago and established their North American seminary. And they also established about the same time a parish in the city of Lincoln, which is solely for the traditional Mass. And so we've always enjoyed a very good relationship with the fraternity. For instance, we have our own college seminary, St. Gregory the Great, where we have seminarians from eight to 10 different dioceses in the area. And our seminarians and their seminarians engage in soccer and basketball. We go over there for their feast day on Our Lady of Guadalupe and have a great Mexican feast day because they have a lot of Mexican seminarians because they're the North American seminary. And they come over to our seminary for our feast day. And then we also have joint efforts, like, for instance, pro-life marches and things like that. So there's been a great harmony and sort of like I like to say, kind of a cross-pollination of those who prefer the traditional mass or those who prefer the ordinary mass. There's not any tension between the two. Yeah.
And the FSSP was started by priests who left SSPX after that order's founder defied the Holy See. Now, Your Excellency, we are just days away from SSPX's planned ordination of bishops without papal approval, which will result in a schism, according to the Vatican itself. What's your reaction to this news development and where things have ended up right now with the SSPX?
It's very sad because in the history of the church, whenever they're is an ordination of a bishop without a papal mandate, it always causes a schism. It always causes a break, a division. And it's very sad because I know Pope Benedict worked very hard. He was the one that lifted the excommunication in 2009 as a gesture of, openness and willing to talk. And then there seemed to have been a lot of dialogue going back and forth. But then now, as I understand it, they've decided to go forward with these ordinations. So it's anytime there's division in the church and, you know, an act like this clearly breaks the apostolic link to Peter, really. And it's so clear that, and they know this, canon law teaches this, that throughout history, it always causes schism and division.
And there are many Catholics who are sympathetic to the Society of St. Pius X because of their celebration of the traditional Latin Mass. Cardinal Gerhard Müller, who previously served as the prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, had this to say to any Catholics who are still considering attending Mass at an SSPX church. Let's take a listen.
They shouldn't go and cannot go participate in the masses of the schismatic priests.
You cannot go. A clear and direct statement from His Eminence right there. Your Excellency, what guidance do you want to offer a Catholic who is drawn to the TLM and still considering attending an SSPX Mass at this point?
Well, I would agree with His Eminence. You just can't go. And, you know, there is a resurgence of interest in all things traditional, especially among young people. I see it in my own diocese. They want reverence. They want transcendence. They want beauty in the liturgy. And, you know, thanks be to God, we have not only the Fraternity of St. Peter, but I have a couple of priests who celebrate with permission of the Holy See a Sunday Mass in the extraordinary form. Mm-hmm. And, as you know, it's interesting, the Fraternity St. Peter's Seminary is full every year, 90 seminarians. So it's my hope that as they continue to ordain priests, they're going to be ordaining priests here next year again, as they do every day, so ordain 12, that they will go out and they'll be able to, like the story with Arlington, they'll be able to meet the needs of the people who desire this form of the Mass. And I think that's really what the end goal should be. And people should not be forced or have to feel like they have to go to a Mass which is celebrated by a community or a priest that's broken with Peter.
I thank you for highlighting that and just letting people be aware that these communities do exist. Your Excellency, it's been almost 5 years since Traditionis Custodes was promulgated and restrictions on the celebration of the Mass in Latin were imposed worldwide. For Catholics who feel especially affected and upset by that, what is the line for having legitimate concerns about liturgy while maintaining obedience to the Holy Father and not going down a path of separation from ecclesial authority? Can you talk about that?
Well, again, I think it goes back to a desire for more reverence in the liturgy. I'm a member of the board of directors for the Institute of Pope Benedict XVI for Sacred Liturgy. So I believe that we're seeing a trend turning more traditional, even in the Novus Ordo. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a good thing. And I think, especially, like I said, young people are desiring more reverent, more transcendent Mass. And I think that those are going to be more and more available. So for those who are, let's say, looking for something, I just say be patient. Find a church that's nearby you can go to from a fraternity of St. Peter Parish, or you know your own diocesan priest. I know these younger priests that are being ordained are already learning you know different forms of the Mass. So I think there's a lot of hope. Yeah. So don't give up and don't jump ship.
Mm, that's a great message. And Your Excellency, you are an adult convert to the Catholic faith, a really beautiful faith journey that's led to you being elevated a bishop in the church. Do you mind reflecting, what role did the Mass and the liturgy play in your own conversion experience and in your relationship with Christ?
It was huge. And one of my first experiences as a young Catholic, I'd only been a Catholic for less than a year, I visited the Benedictine Monastery of Fontgombault in France, which at the time, interestingly, were celebrating the Novus Ordo, but it was in the beautiful tradition of the Benedictine Salem congregation. And I was just blown away by the beauty, the Gregorian chant, the transcendence. It was otherworldly. It was like the cosmic liturgy. And that was my first year as a Catholic. And I, when the indult came out to say the old Mass, I was one of the first ones to get the indult in 1988. And so I've been celebrating the traditional Mass most of my priesthood. Mm. And now that I'm in Lincoln, I have more occasion to do it, right, because we have Carmelites who have the extraordinary form. And, of course, the fraternity seminary, I do some of their ordinations. And I also do confirmations at St. Francis, which is the fraternity parish. So it's played a huge part. And it's actually helped me to celebrate the Novus Ordo, which by and large, the ordinary form, 95% of the time I'm celebrating that. It's helped me to understand its roots, where it came from, but also the gestures and the importance of reverence, every gesture, every moment that you're in the Mass. So it's helped me celebrate the Mass, the ordinary form, in a better way.
That is beautiful. We're grateful for your own faith witness and for joining us this week, Bishop Conley. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next week on this program, we will have an update on what happens with the SSPX's proposed consecrations. Still to come on this edition of EWTN News in Depth, earthquake tragedy in Venezuela, a rising death toll and thousands missing. We talked to an international Catholic relief agency about how you can help, and
data centers are downstream from a larger question, which is like the desires of the human heart, the lonelinesses in the human heart. Like, why is there so much demand?
We have an in-depth look at the controversy over data centers and what they do to a community of neighbors and a community of the heart. We have guidance from Pope Leo XIV's new encyclical, Magnifica Humanitas.
This like theme of unity, I think, is so beautiful, especially in this current time in our country where we need a lot of healing and a big reminder that we are one nation under God.
Words of wisdom from perpetual pilgrims who have experienced the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage as we wind towards the finish of this summer's journey. EWTN News in Depth is coming right back.
I'm desperate. I just want to know where my son is, whether he's trapped or at a shelter. I'm desperate. The governor said they were going to send heavy machinery, but look what time it is. They still haven't arrived. It's only the neighbors here helping.
Venezuelans wait for answers and desperately search for loved ones after two devastating earthquakes turn hundreds of buildings into rubble. Even as the international community intervenes to support search and rescue efforts, thousands of people remain unaccounted for. The back-to-back earthquakes struck the South American nation on Wednesday night, killing nearly 600 people with a rising death toll and injuring more than 3,000 others. Many, many more are displaced after their homes collapsed during the quake. The earthquakes were some of the country's strongest in nearly a century and hit Venezuela's populous northern states, including the capital, Caracas. Much of the area is experiencing power and internet outages, preventing family members outside the country from reaching their loved ones. Recovery will be a challenge for Venezuela, a country already grappling with a dire economic and political crisis. A research physicist with the U.S. Geological Survey's Earthquake Information Center says the damage is extensive.
And really, when a big earthquake like this occurs, what we're worried about is not just the size of the earthquake, but how shallow the earthquake is and how close it is to dense population centers. In this case, it was a very shallow earthquake. It occurred close to people. So it's very worrying, and we expect it to be very damaging. And I think it's going to take days to weeks to really understand the extent of this damage.
Along with immediate search and rescue help, the United States announced it would provide $150 million to aid groups. On Thursday, the Vatican donated 100,000 euros and said more aid will follow in response to the needs identified by local churches in Venezuela. The chairman of the U.S. Bishops Committee on International Peace and Justice is urging humanitarian aid in wake of the Venezuelan earthquakes. In comments released by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, Bishop Elias Zaidan offered his prayers in solidarity, stating, "I urge the international community to mobilize in support of the Venezuelan people and to send the necessary humanitarian assistance to alleviate their suffering." Catholic Relief Services, the international relief agency of the Church in the United States, and its partner Caritas Venezuela are already responding and assessing needs at this early stage. And joining us now is a Catholic Relief Services disaster relief expert to discuss the church's response to the devastating earthquakes in Venezuela. Nicholas Meslawi is the regional team lead for humanitarian response for Latin America and the Caribbean for Catholic Relief Services. He joins us from the neighboring country of Colombia with plans to be in Venezuela early next week, depending on the state of the airport there. Nicolas, thank you so much for being with us now. You have been in close communication with Catholic aid responders on the ground in Venezuela. What can you tell us about the situation there right now?
Yes, well, thank you so much for your time today. The situation on the ground is devastating. People are looking for their loved ones. People are wondering where they would sleep. Search and rescue efforts are starting, mainly in the main cities, but many states have been affected. People do not know where to eat, are looking for medical assistance. People are afraid to go back to their homes. The situation is devastating right now. And we have to remember that we're talking about a country that has been grappling for years of many crises, people who are already facing difficulties to meet their basic needs. And so this is just adding a major crisis within the crisis. So it is a very concerning situation right now on the ground.
Well, on that very note, Nicolas, do you have a sense of how the Venezuelan government has been responding in the wake of this tragedy? Because, as you mentioned, this is just the latest challenge for them, as Venezuela has been facing economic disarray, and many of those Venezuelans have been rejecting the legitimacy of the political movement that acting President Delcy Rodriguez represents. So what's been the government's response immediately following the earthquake?
Well, the Venezuelan government has started to respond immediately. Now the challenges are huge. They have asked for international assistance, primarily right now on search and rescue and medical assistance, just because of the scale of the emergency. But as you mentioned, we know they are facing already a lot of crises. They lack machineries, they lack manpower, infrastructure, and so aid is on its way. There's still a lot more that is needed. Mm. We're particularly concerned about access to healthcare, and the search and rescue efforts right now in those first hours.
And when there is a disaster of this scale, what help do people need the most? And how does the immediate help compare to the long-term help that's necessary following an earthquake like this?
Well, that's a very good question. Right now, people need a place where to stay. They need food, they need medical assistance, but they also need mental health support. People are shocked, people are afraid. They do not want to go back to their home. That's why church facilities, the Catholic Church, has opened its assistance centers from the very first hour. People knocked on their doors asking for food, asking for shelter, asking to be listened to. And that's the very first few hours, the very first few days and weeks. We need to save lives. We also need to make sure people can meet their basic needs. But then we know the way to recovery is going to be very long. Yeah. This type of emergency, we've had a lot of experience. They don't take days or weeks. They take months or years for people to rebuild their lives and recover. Mm-hmm.
And I understand CRS, Catholic Relief Services, is working in partnership with Caritas Venezuela, which is leading the response on the ground. What kind of relief is being provided in Venezuela? What work is Caritas and CRS doing right now?
Well, let me start by saying that the response started the very first hour after the earthquake. We're talking about providing hot meals. We're talking about providing blankets and clothing. We're talking about providing medical assistance, mental health support. And that's going to continue. That's continuing now. We know there's going to be needs longer term to rebuild businesses, to rebuild homes. But right now, we're really focusing on saving lives. In this type of emergency, what really matters is staying in the long term, not just the immediate few days, few weeks, where a lot of assistance is coming, but being able to help people rebuild their lives. Those buildings that we're seeing on the video, those images, this is not something that can be fixed really in the short term. Right now, people need us to save their lives. They need to be feel listened to. And so the church shelters, the church soup kitchens, and all the assistance that can be done is distributed right now as we speak.
Nicolas, I have just about a minute left with you, but I want to ask, you've been working in disaster relief for some time, and now there's hundreds of people who are dead, thousands reported missing, nearly 3,000 injured. It's such a tragedy on a massive scale. Based on your experience, I mean, how are you and humanitarian aid workers and emergency responders, how are you able to not get overwhelmed by the scale of this tragedy?
Well, I'd just like to highlight the courage of humanitarian workers right now in Venezuela. We're talking about hundreds of Caritas volunteers and workers at the parish, at the diocese, and at the national level. They have personally been affected by this emergency. Some of their loved ones are missing, and yet they're on the ground helping, providing assistance. Mm-hmm. CRS is on the ground. More assistance is coming. Our experts are traveling as we speak to provide assistance. And yes, it can be overwhelming, but what motivates us is that we can put our faith into action and support our brothers and sisters in Venezuela right now when they need us most.
Nicolas, thank you for taking time, and we are praying for Venezuela. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for your time.
If you want to contribute to the Catholic relief efforts in Venezuela right now, you can go to crs.org/donate/Venezuela-earthquake. When we come back, we go to Data Center Alley.
Data centers are great at generating additional revenue, but to what end? To what end? And that's a question I ask often.
Data centers and all they represent, good or bad or somewhere in between. We go in depth with a Catholic perspective on technology that is overwhelming almost every aspect of our lives. Fact of modern life, we are connected to the world on our phones. It is nearly impossible to put them down, and artificial intelligence is impacting us all. And at the heart of that is the data center infrastructure needed to power our devices. These massive buildings springing up all over the countryside are the source of great controversy and tension to those who live near them. And beyond that, our reliance on our interconnected digital technology is of concern to our church, as evidenced by Pope Leo XIV's encyclical Magnifica Humanitas. EWTN News In Depth turned to reporter Mark Irons to unpack this complicated issue.
If you're watching this report online or have ever scrolled, searched, shopped, emailed, carried out basically any basic task that requires web access, it's not possible without data centers. And it's even possible your internet traffic could have passed right through here.
Data Center Alley, right?
That's right.
Warehouses. Warehouses of your data and mine.
Northern Virginia, not far from Washington, D.C., where you'll find hundreds of the gigantic warehouses packed with computer servers and the infrastructure needed to process and power our ever-growing digital world. Major companies like Google, Amazon, and Microsoft have a presence. There are more data centers concentrated here than any other place in the world. They border the highway, some residential neighborhoods, others not far from churches. Data Center Alley falls within the boundaries of the Catholic Diocese of Arlington, Virginia. This diocese, home to 70 Catholic parishes, and in the same area, more than three times the number of data centers.
In the Catholic Church context, there are more data centers in the Diocese of Arlington than any other place in the world. Has the local church been paying attention to that? Has it been thinking about that?
Well, yeah, of course. It's absolutely in people's minds to be
thinking about how to shepherd and pastor the flock.
Anna Kinnear is the coordinator for the Peace and Justice Commission in the diocese. Our conversation was timely, coming on the heels of Pope Leo's encyclical, Magnifica Humanitas, which addresses the need to protect human dignity as the use of artificial intelligence rapidly expands.
It's coming fast and quickly, and it's a kind of a, we're building the plane as we fly a little bit in terms of all sorts of considerations, including infrastructure.
Part of the infrastructure of artificial intelligence means more data centers. And with AI relying on an excess supply of data and computing power, the development of these digital storehouses is accelerating. Some see it as a good thing, with the jobs these facilities can bring and the abundance of tax revenue they can generate for the benefit of the communities where they're built, which can include tax relief for local citizens. In his encyclical, Pope Leo repeated the words of one of his predecessors, a saint, Pope Paul VI, who said, "The most extraordinary scientific progress, the most astounding technical feats, and the most amazing economic growth, unless accompanied by authentic moral and social progress, will in the long run go against man." And for some who live near Data Center Alley in Loudoun County, the progress next door is causing them problems.
It makes noise 24/7. The noise itself affects people's health.
We heard the different concerns in the neighborhood next to the Vantage Data Center.
Whatever they're doing, it's causing us a respiratory issue. That's my main concern.
The part that really gets me is the noise penetration into my home.
To escape the noise and see what life was like outside Data Center Alley, we headed for the country. 2 hours south, the town of Louisa, Virginia offers small-town charm. And on Main Street, Floozies provides a tasty slice of pie. But stick around after dessert, and local patrons might even give you a piece of their mind.
I realize that technology has to grow and everything, but
they're just an eyesore.
The noise, the pollution, all those kinds of things.
Everyone we spoke to had something to say, mostly negative about data centers. Two of them are under development here in Louisa County.
I come from Northern Virginia. We moved down here 5 years ago. It's like following us.
It's taking advantage of rural communities like this.
A Gallup poll from this year showed 7 in 10 Americans oppose constructing data centers for artificial intelligence in their local area.
Virginia is the dumping ground of data centers.
But criticism is spreading across the U.S. Another Pew Research Center survey found as Americans learn a lot more about data centers, they are expressing concerns about home energy costs and the environmental impact. Data centers need massive amounts of energy to stay powered and water for cooling to keep the servers from overheating.
It's sucking up electricity. It's sucking up water resources.
Just the amount of natural resources in general being drained.
In his encyclical, Pope Leo noted, it is essential to develop more sustainable technological solutions that reduce environmental impact and help protect our common home. For this rural community, the issue hits close to home, in particular, the home of Austin Newsom, who lives with his family in the once quiet countryside of Louisa. Now dump trucks are constantly on the move across from his front yard, where an enormous Amazon data center is under construction.
If you could speak to Amazon officials directly, what would you say to them?
They wouldn't want to live here. They wouldn't live here. If this was their house, they wouldn't accept it. They wouldn't be okay with it.
This data center is far from completion, but Austin says the quality of life here has already declined from the noise and dust that comes over from the construction site.
Some days you're out there and it's hard to breathe. The kids don't like it. The kids really hate it because they can't jump on the trampoline without getting covered in dust. They go jump on the trampoline and just clouds of dust coming off the trampoline.
Austin runs a boat repair shop on his property. With a lake nearby, summer business is typically booming. But with all the construction dust flying over, coating high-end boats in dirt, customers are staying away.
How much drop-off in business have you seen?
Quite a bit. With in-shop work and bigger jobs, I usually would have 15, 20, 25 boats in my parking lot at any given time, and right now I've got two.
Did you have any say in this coming up right across the street from your house?
I didn't. I got one little itty-bitty piece of paper, about a town meeting, about an Amazon data center. And of course, they schedule these meetings at 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon when the average person's at work. Not everybody can just leave work.
Those public meetings were hosted by the Louisa County Board of Supervisors. The board would vote to ultimately approve construction. In a document released to the public explaining its position, the county notes the benefit of potential tax revenue coming in from the Amazon data centers, writing, annual new county revenues could exceed $25 million annually, which could be used for tax relief, core public services such as schools and public safety, infrastructure enhancements, and other priorities.
You know, the real concerns that nobody knows of the real impacts of how is this going to affect the town's drinking water?
An Amazon spokesperson told us when it comes to data centers, Amazon is committed to environmental responsibility and complies with all environmental regulations, including those related to water quality, air emissions, stormwater management, noise levels, and waste disposal. And they said Amazon works with utility operators to plan and invest in power grid development and improvements. A sign back in the pie shop window protests, no more data centers. And next door, another sign rejects a proposed high-voltage transmission line.
One of those routes does come right through the middle of my property.
Data centers need power, and lots of it. Austin says one proposed path for a transmission line would cut right through the patch of grass between his house and boat shop.
Could you live with that there?
Absolutely not. You're talking massive power lines, 200 feet tall in the air, with a 200-foot, you know, easement. I wouldn't have any yard left. The easement's going to be pretty close to my house.
If they built that line through there, what happens to your shop?
They tear it down.
They tear it down?
Tear it down.
You're out of business.
Out of business.
Pope Leo writes, the devastating impact of unemployment and job insecurity on family structures is well known. Critics say though data centers bring in temporary jobs, once built, they operate with a limited staff. More broadly, there are concerns that entire sectors of human labor could be replaced by artificial intelligence. Whatever the future holds, the Pope reminds us, we must avoid the misconception of equating this type of intelligence with that of human beings.
Well, as a Protestant, yes, I support the Pope wholeheartedly in what he is saying.
Deshondra Jefferson is chair-at-large on the Board of County Supervisors in Prince William County, a few counties north of Louisa where data center growth has already exploded. Unlike some of her other board members, Jefferson is more cautious about data center expansion, but she does note some of the positives.
What benefits has this county seen from the data centers that are already here?
We have been able to lower our taxes. Our personal property tax, or AKA the car tax, we have a meals tax that was 4%. It's now down to 3%. And we've been able to reduce our real estate tax rate while giving the schools record amounts of funding every year.
The votes made by her and her fellow county board members have the power to approve or deny requests from developers.
Now, I have voted for more data centers than I have voted against, but I have a hard line. There are certain places data centers don't belong, and that's near houses, that's near schools, that's near sensitive cultural and historic resources. And there has been pushback on that. I'm simply looking for common sense limits.
What's in place to prevent this from getting out of control?
Where developers are coming in and say, hey, you know, I know that maybe this you want a park here, but we'd like to do data centers. Well, you know, I know that maybe you want more housing here, but we'd like to do data centers. So there isn't a strong enough plan. And I'm one of eight on the board. We have people all over the place on this issue.
Prince William County also sits in the Diocese of Arlington. Anna says, at a minimum, data centers are controversial. And while some might point out the benefits, the church does not forget those who might be suffering.
We need to be with those who are on the margins. And the margins aren't that far away. I could drive there this afternoon.
She also pointed out something else, how our digital decisions, though they may seem minor at times, really do mean something.
My phone suddenly tells me I'm out of storage and I don't know what to do. And so I'll pay the $299 to rent a storage unit for my data in Loudoun County, but I'm not thinking about it that way.
You don't think about that.
No, I'm just...
It just goes to the cloud.
I'm literally sort of baffled. There's no cloud.
Where is the cloud?
It's a physical storage unit.
These data centers, many of them are popping up as a result of the expansion of AI. A lot of us are using it right here on our phones. Do you find yourself using AI? How culpable are we in all of this?
I do use AI a little bit. It is kind of contradicted. I'm complaining about it, but I also use it. It is a nice tool to have, but not something you want, in your backyard.
Technology is part of our daily lives and will undoubtedly develop. Pope Leo reminds us our use of it must serve the good of humanity. He calls us to build up a society where human dignity is always respected, to keep God at the center of our lives. Human creativity and innovation can help construct a more loving civilization if we're united to Christ, the cornerstone. He says, we are called to reflect on the great construction sites of our era and ask, what are we building? Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
And Mark joins me now in studio to discuss his extensive reporting on data center concerns. Mark, great report. And it's striking to me how locals largely have these strong negative reactions to the development of these data centers. And yet we as a society, we're increasingly dependent on them. So is there a resolution or solution here?
All right. Well, just taking a step back from data centers, I think it's easy to be overwhelmed with all the latest technology, AI, the algorithms, all the screens. We forget that we do have a role to play in the society we build. And the diocesan official we spoke to in the story said, we're responsible. So don't be overwhelmed, but do discern the decisions you're making in your use of the latest tech. And is it for the good?
And in your everyday life, what does that look like? And I mean, Pope Leo's encyclical, Magnificat Humanitas, especially relevant here.
Great place to start.
Yeah.
Read the encyclical. Mm-hmm. But just to be clear, the Pope isn't saying that AI is objectively bad. In fact, we know that it can be used for good if it's used to serve humanity. But again, it's about discernment. And I think the Pope lays out some really great practical considerations for us in that encyclical. Yeah.
Well, Mark, great report.
Thank you
so much. News headlines are next in the Week in Review. The latest in peace negotiations between the United States and Iran, top headlines in the Week in Review. It's been a little more than a week since the two nations remotely signed a temporary peace agreement, reopening the critical Strait of Hormuz and guaranteeing a new round of further negotiations. But those talks are already showing signs of strain. The first round of talks took place in Switzerland last weekend, and another round is expected to take place next week. Washington and Tehran remain at odds on several points, including Iran's frozen funds, its nuclear program, and the Strait, a choke point for one-fifth of the world's oil. New tensions erupted in the Strait on Thursday after Iranian forces struck a vessel. Iran maintains that it will keep control over the Strait, but the U.S. emphasizes the passage is international waters. After meeting with key allies in the region, Secretary of State Marco Rubio says the U.S. will not allow Iran to enact a toll on ships.
One thing that came across very clear is there is zero support among the Gulf countries for any sort of toll or fees or anything that charges for the use of international waters. The president's made it clear that's not going to happen. It's not going to be a part of this.
Back in the U.S., tensions over the war between the White House and Capitol Hill. On Tuesday, after several previous attempts, the Senate passed a war powers resolution meant to block the war in Iran. But shortly after that vote, President Donald Trump exchanged harsh words with two Republican senators, Rand Paul and Bill Cassidy, who sided with Democratic colleagues to advance it. On late Wednesday night, the Senate voted on a similar war powers resolution, and the two lawmakers walked back their rebuke of Trump, and the resolution failed to pass. Plumes of smoke once again rising over southern Lebanon on Friday in the wake of new Israeli airstrikes. Israel and Iran-backed Hezbollah agreed to a ceasefire last week after one of its most intense rounds of fighting since the war began. These flare-ups between Israel and Iran-backed Hezbollah continue to complicate negotiations between the U.S. and Iran, which has maintained that any peace agreement must include a ceasefire in Lebanon. Israel's defense minister reiterated this week that the IDF would not retreat. A bit of whiplash this week on Capitol Hill. President Trump suddenly canceled a signing ceremony at the U.S. Capitol for a new affordable housing law passed by large bipartisan majorities in both the House and Senate. The housing bill is the largest of its kind in decades and focuses on increasing housing supply, lowering costs, and stopping private equity firms from snapping up single-family homes. With Americans feeling a housing affordability crisis, the signing ceremony on Wednesday was supposed to signal to the public that Congress is listening to their financial stress. President Trump was on Capitol Hill, but abruptly called off the ceremony to create pressure on Congress to instead pass his Save America Act, which would make sweeping changes in how Americans register to vote.
Americans want housing costs to go down, and we have a law that is passed through the House, through the Senate, big bipartisan majorities. ready to go. And Donald Trump wakes up this morning and decides he just can't sign it into law. Understand, this is the biggest housing package coming out of the United States government in more than 30 years.
You know, I said I'm not signing the housing bill. I want to see what happens. We said, look, the housing bill is housing. I made billions of dollars with housing. I know housing better than anybody, maybe anywhere. It's all about the interest rate. Lower the interest rates, you can have all the housing you want.
Though the SAVE Act passed the House, it does not have enough Senate support to become law. In the meantime, the housing bill sits unsigned. Unless the president attempts to veto it, it will automatically become law without his signature in 10 days. Camp Mystic is closed. This week, the all-girls Christian summer camp in Texas filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. 28 people were killed there last July, including 25 young campers, when flash floods swept through the low-lying area. Families of the victims filed a lawsuit last year saying the camp operators did not take the necessary steps to protect the girls as life-threatening floodwaters approached. Until April of this year, the camp had said it would reopen this summer to preserve the decades of tradition cherished by hundreds of Texas families. But fierce public backlash and investigations showing poor emergency flood planning forced the closure. Camp Mystic's bankruptcy filing pauses legal actions seeking millions of dollars in damages. With just a week left until its summer recess, the Supreme Court has yet to release opinions on some of its most closely watched cases, including on the issue of birthright citizenship. But on Thursday, the justices issued two other rulings on migration. By a vote of 6-3 along ideological lines, the court ruled in Mullen versus Doe that the Trump administration can end temporary protected status for Haitian and Syrian nationals residing in the United States. This ruling impacts hundreds of thousands of migrants who came to the U.S. to flee violence and natural disaster. In another 6-3 vote, the Supreme Court ruled in Mullen versus Al Otralado that the administration can turn away asylum seekers along the U.S.-Mexico border, preventing them from even stepping onto U.S. soil. Pope Leo gathered the church's cardinals to Rome this week for the second extraordinary consistory of this pontificate. The two-day meeting serves as an opportunity for the prelates to discuss key issues for the church. In his opening remarks on Friday, the Holy Father called the cardinals to frankness and to loyalty.
Help me to listen to what is emerging in the churches, to recognize the signs of hope that often grow in silence, but also to not ignore the struggles, misunderstandings, and resistance that can slow down our journey. I need your freedom, your frankness, and your loyalty. Sincere advice is always an act of communion.
The consistory concludes on Saturday. Cardinals are reflecting on four themes: the church's view of the world, peace, the common good, and synodality. During Pope Leo's first consistory in January, he announced that he planned to gather the cardinals to Rome every year. His predecessor, Pope Francis, seldom held extraordinary consistories. Tickets for renowned television evangelist Archbishop Fulton Sheen's upcoming beatification, the first beatification of a U.S.-born bishop, are now available. But hurry, they are going fast. Sheen's beatification mass is set for September 24th at The Dome at America's Center in St. Louis, Missouri. The venue will open early that day for reconciliation, Eucharistic adoration, and a special pre-beatification program. It's all part of a broader pilgrimage experience with official Sheen pilgrimage events in both Sheen's hometown of Peoria, Illinois, and in St. Louis. Go to celebratesheen.com to see all the details and to get your beatification tickets. Already, it's upper-level seating that remains available at this point.
I looked over to the person sitting next to me. I was like, we live in a time where we can put Jesus on a boat, an automated boat, and just drive him across an ocean. Like, what is that?
The wondrous experience of young adults escorting the true presence of Christ in a pilgrimage through the original 13 colonies. Inspiration, faith, and hope when we come back. There is one full week left in this summer's 2026 National Eucharistic Pilgrimage, a journey with the true presence of Christ in the Eucharist that is also celebrating the 250th anniversary of the United States. The itinerary has been an ambitious one, traveling through most of the original 13 colonies, starting in St. Augustine, Florida, over the Memorial Day weekend and ending in Philadelphia over the July 4th weekend, just days from now. Among the people most touched by this trip are the 9 young pilgrims selected to travel with the Blessed Sacrament the entire way. They are called perpetual pilgrims. As EWTN News in Depth has traveled on the St. Francis Xavier Cabrini route, several of those pilgrims shared their faith journey in depth with reporter Roselle Regis.
I said yes to becoming a pilgrim because I just want to spread the love of Jesus Christ to everyone we meet on this journey.
Marcel Ferrer is one of the perpetual pilgrims for this year's National Eucharistic Pilgrimage. This small group of young adults said yes to Jesus, dedicating their summer to him, carrying the Blessed Sacrament from St. Augustine, Florida, to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, spending time with him day in and day out.
I don't have any specific intentions for myself. I just want to see how God works in my heart and, you know, Scripture says you don't need to know like the place or time, so I just want to be open and willing to wherever he leads me, you know.
Ferrer grew up Catholic but fell away from the faith during adolescence.
Just from a young age, really followed our Catholic faith, but it wasn't really like my own, you know. I never really had a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And in high school, I kind of fell away from the faith for a while, but luckily one of my friends invited me to a youth retreat. And it really changed my life, and I had an encounter with Jesus there in the Eucharist, and here I am.
Since his powerful experience with our Lord in the Eucharist, his mission now is to draw other people closer to Christ. It is a calling to become a pilgrim, requiring intense spiritual, physical, and mental resilience. That is why the pilgrims are usually accompanied by priest chaplains and a team leader. Cheyenne Johnson knows all about the pilgrim experience. She served as a perpetual pilgrim last year, where she traveled with Jesus cross-country from Indianapolis to Los Angeles. She returned as a team lead this year and is excited to walk alongside others.
I think serving as team lead, it's a lot more like service and pastoral focused, like on the team too. So just making sure that I'm there for the team, supporting them, because this is their first time. And so bringing that experience and helping them to feel comfortable in their roles as they get used to being on pilgrimage. So yeah, I'm just hoping to grow in that. And I can already see that happening just as we form like our own family on pilgrimage.
Aside from visiting different locations this year, Johnson said the themes for each pilgrimage are also unique, which made her say yes to the journey once more.
Last year was the Jubilee Year of Hope, so really leaning into that sentiment of bringing hope and healing to people. But this being the 250th anniversary of our country, just a lot of prayers for our nation, praying for unity and praying for people to come encounter the Lord.
Johnson can't wait to meet more people along the way and see what the Holy Spirit brings about this time around.
Excited to encounter him in a whole new way, because just spending that much time with the Blessed Sacrament, like, he continues to work in my heart and amaze me at what he's calling me to and the ways that he speaks and just the amazing things that he wants to do.
At the midpoint in Washington, D.C., I caught up with perpetual pilgrims Mary Carmen Sacrisic and Eduardo Gutierrez.
Perpetual pilgrims, you guys are not only processing, you're also trying to go out and evangelize and educate people. Tell me, what is the feedback you've been getting?
It has been really great. Yeah, the other day we were at a homeless outreach organization doing some service, and there was a gentleman wearing a rosary. And I looked at him, I was like, oh, you're wearing a rosary. And we started talking a little bit. And then I left, and my pilgrim and I were thinking, you know, maybe we should go back and teach him how to pray the rosary. Maybe he hasn't prayed it before. So we did, and he asked us to write down the prayers, and he left that day with 3 more rosaries. One of the other pilgrims gave him a how to pray rosary card, and we just got to walk through it with him, and he loved it. It was incredible.
I think people are just so curious, and they really, really have open hearts, and it's sort of like a longing for something more, and that something more they're looking for is just walking right here with them. So Jesus came to encounter them, and then we're just so happy to invite them in and just come and pray with us.
In the nation's capital, we also ran into 2 former perpetual pilgrims, Leslie Reyes Hernandez and Ace Acuna.
So last summer we had the beautiful gift of being pilgrims. Ace and I were on the same team. So now we are on the other side, of course, but I think what's so beautiful is that our Lord is still here. And we are still pilgrims with him no matter what, because at the end of the day, we all want to get to heaven. And of course, that's the end goal. So we are on our route together, pushing each other to be holy day by day.
Would you recommend being a pilgrim to other people?
Oh, yes, please, please, please. Once in a lifetime experience. I always think back to the apostles being with Jesus.
I think being a perpetual pilgrim is very special. You do kind of feel like one of the disciples, just living life with him day in, day out. And there's no other experience that I've ever had that has quite lived up to that. So highly recommend. To anyone who's thinking about following our Lord, if you've ever felt drawn to give your summer to him in a radical way and follow in his footsteps, quite literally, being a pilgrim is the way to do it.
The perpetual pilgrims have just more than 1 week left, traveling the eastern seaboard and, in the process, having fun.
Ooh, when I went on a retreat and for the first time ever, I finally felt seen.
Rosal Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
Earlier this week, the pilgrims reached the northernmost point of the pilgrimage near Portland, Maine, before swinging south this weekend to Boston, our nation's fourth largest diocese and home to nearly 2 million Catholics. The grand conclusion of the 2026 National Eucharistic Pilgrimage occurs in Philadelphia on July 4th weekend on our nation's 250th anniversary. The concluding Mass will be celebrated at 11 a.m. on Sunday, July 5th at Philadelphia's Cathedral Basilica of Saints Peter and Paul, followed by a 2-mile Eucharistic procession through downtown Philadelphia beginning at 12:30 p.m. And then we'll conclude with a benediction at the National Shrine of St. John Newman at St. Peter the Apostle Church. Tune in to EWTN for full live coverage of the concluding festivities of the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage beginning at 10:30 a.m. Eastern on July 5th. I will be here along with my co-hosts, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, editorial director of EWTN News, and Father Aquinas Gilbo, chaplain and director of campus ministry at the Catholic University of America. We hope you'll join us for our live coverage, and we also hope to see you again right here for next week's edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Until I see you again, God bless.